video. Today we want to look at implications of anomalies, and the first process we're going to look at is pion decay. And this is how the anomaly was discovered. It emerged in the context of current algebra and massless QCD. So we saw last time that a Lagrangian of massless fermions in QCD has a global flavor symmetry. And back in the 1960s, there were, there were three quarks proposed, but two of them appeared to be very light, the up and the down. And it was thought that perhaps they were massless, or we could do physics assuming they were massless, in which case the QCD Lagrangian had this global flavor symmetry. And the pions were Goldstone bosons associated with the breaking of this symmetry. And one assumed that the pion mass was approximately zero. It wasn't exactly zero, but it was thought that perhaps that was a good symmetry or a good assumption relative to the masses of all the other nucleons. So there was a current, J mu 5, which was Q bar gamma mu gamma 5 tau A Q. And the pions were states that, oopsie-daisy, that obeyed this property here, that this was I F pi delta A B P mu, where this would be the pion momentum. And this worked great for a number of processes. So for example, pi plus or minus goes to mu plus or minus plus the associated neutrino. Tau is a polymatrix, yes. Maybe I should call it sigma. It's often called tau. So the sigma A are polys. Sorry about that. Yes. Yeah, they're the SU2 polymatrices. I've got tau in my notes. I'll try to remember to use sigma. They're the polymatrices. So this worked great here, but for pi 0, new... Let me just do that. These have to be charged. This is either nu or nu bar, depending on which sign of the pion charge you have. But the pion was known to decay into two photons, and it worked badly. Yeah. Where did which? Sorry. Delta A B, I'm sorry, that's a B. Thanks for pointing that out. So there are three currents associated with the three sigmas, pi plus, pi zero, pi minus. So J plus on pi plus gives something, J minus on pi minus gives something, and J zero on pi zero gives something. Sorry, there's a B. Thanks for pointing that out. Is that what you were? Yeah. You guys are sharp. You don't miss a thing. This idea worked great for this process and for a number of other meson decay processes, but it didn't work very well for this one. And in particular, the pi zero is given by the action, or maybe I should write it like this, zero J mu 5 acting on the neutral pion should be IF pi P mu. So I've got the 0, 0 part here, where J mu 5, 0, I'm getting tired of writing that. Zero would be a half of u bar gamma mu u, u bar gamma mu gamma 5 u minus down gamma mu gamma 5 down. So the zeroth component would be sigma 0 or sigma 3. And sigma 3, remember, is sigma 3 is a half 1, 0, 0, negative 1 when we put in. Maybe I'm going to leave this as a tau, and I'll say tau A is a half sigma A, because that's the generator, that's the Pauli matrix, more correctly. So that's where that half comes from. So how did people compute this process? Well, we want the state gamma pi pi. We want to know what that is. And there is a theorem from quantum field theory called the Lehmann-Symantec-Zimmermann theorem, or the LSZ theorem. And it basically says that if you have a time-ordered product of a bunch of quantum fields, then you can write this as the sum. You can basically, you can put in a complete set of states in between these things. And the point of the theorem, the theorem is not going from here to here, and this sum over p would be an integral over p in general. And if I had other possible states, I would have an index up there. The point of the theorem is that this thing is equal to I times 0 acting on this thing divided by k1 squared minus the mass of the psi squared, or the mass of the psi squared, times this state here, and all whatever all of these other operators are, it doesn't matter what they are, plus non-pole terms. So the point of the theorem is that you have a complete set of states that are ultimately made of whatever fields these operators are made of. These could be quantum fields, these could be currents, these are products of a bunch of basic quantum field operators. You can insert a complete set of states, and the theorem says that the term is given by a pole term plus stuff that is a non-pole term. So if we apply that to this problem, then what we will have is that e squared times 0, the time-ordered product of two let me write it the other way. I'll get pi. No, let me write it the first way. I have e squared 0 t of j mu of p1, j nu of p2, and j mu 5 0 acting on 0. I'll use the theorem on this product. So these three things are like what's in there. And I will find, according to this theorem, that I reproduce in here, this will be the J mu 5, and it will act on the pion state according to what's on that blackboard. And it will give I squared F pi over P0 squared. There'll be a P0 mu. And I will get I times gamma gamma. Times pi of P0, and I will get non-pole terms from the theorem, and I'll get the mass of the pi squared, but we will neglect that term because of this Goldstone boson assumption. So, and the other thing I have is that gamma gamma is equal to the vacuum being acted on by these two currents, J mu, J nu of P1, we need a bit more room, multiplied by their polarizations. So the photon states are given by the action of the electromagnetic currents on the vacuum, and this thing acts on the pion state like so, plus a bunch of other non-pole terms. So I'm inserting a complete set of states in there. And the state that, so the pion with this one is that amplitude, and the LSZ theorem on this side gives me this structure here. Yeah. For the I, yeah, there'll still be a sum over I if I have other states, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's the momentum of this pion, yeah. Pardon me? It's contained in here. And we will have, by momentum conservation, that P0 is P1 plus P2. So the problem people ran into was that if you have E squared times P mu acting on this P, this is not right, I need a lambda here, because these are not contracted indices. So if I have this index, P lambda, acting on this structure here, and it will be P0 lambda, by which I mean this is just 0, 1, and 2, and that 0. Well, this thing here should be equal to I squared f pi times P0 squared over P0 squared. Those two things cancel, and I get this gamma gamma pi structure. But what confused people is that this side is supposed to be 0, because the axial current is supposed to be conserved. But we know the pion decays into two photons, so clearly there is something wrong. So current conservation says this should vanish, but the LSZ theorem says this should be true. Of course, there's a P0 mu on the non-pole, but this is tiny, you can show. And then people said, well, look, the pion really isn't massless. It should be corrected. But what you can show is that this thing actually is more like the mass of the pion divided by the mass of the nucleon. And when you put in the numbers properly, it goes like the square of some number here. And what you can show is that theoretical rate was about 10 to the minus 3 of the experimental rate. and this was the problem with the decay of the pion, is that the assumption of the Goldstone boson symmetry, of the broken symmetry of SU2 cross SU2 that made the pion a Goldstone boson, said this should be zero if you took into account the pion isn't really massless but has a mass. It turns out you get this kind of behavior. This is like a tenth of this. You get a factor divided by the nucleon mass of about 0.1 squared. So there's a factor of 1 over 100, and there's another one-tenth that comes into this number. So it turns out when you work it out, you get about a factor of 1,000 smaller than what it actually should be. So the anomaly fixed this problem, which from previous classes we can anticipate. Because what happens in fact is that so the anomaly fixes this because P0 lambda acting on, put an E squared there, acting on the time-ordered product of the two electromagnetic currents is equal to this structure we had last time. It's epsilon nu alpha lambda beta, P1 alpha, P2 beta times epsilon 1 nu, epsilon 2 lambda. I guess I better put a nu there. I'll call this mu and nu to be consistent. Times that, and it's times this factor of 1 over 2 pi squared time and an IE squared. And then we have a number. What we have is a diagram that is basically this current. This is this J mu 5. And we have quarks. This is a photon. This is epsilon 1 P1. This is epsilon 2 P2, and we have the cross diagram. So we have up and down quarks going around there. So how many do we have? Well, each quark has three colors, or rather some number of colors. It wasn't clear how many there were back in the 1960s. And the diagram is proportional to the electric charge here times the electric charge there. Well, quarks don't have normal electric charge. They have fractional electric charge. So the up quark loop will be the number of up quark colors times Q up E, Q up E. And the down quark will be the same thing, except because of the structure of this current, we get a minus sign. So it'll be minus the square of the down quark. And because of that half, we'll get a factor of a half there. And so the anomaly actually gives us this structure. And so this is what is equal to gamma gamma pi, that amplitude. And so when you calculate the decay rate, it's 1 over 2 factorial times 1 over twice the mass of the pion times this phase space integral that is 2 pi cubed, 2 pi cubed, 1 over twice E1, 1 over twice E2 times this four-dimensional delta function. Well, I'll call it P0, times the sum over the spins, or maybe I should say polarizations, times gamma gamma pi quantity squared. Have you guys seen the cross-section decay rate formulas before? This is okay? All right. So when you work out this integral, I won't do all of the details here. You end up getting a half 1 over 16 pi m pi times times the square of this amplitude. And I'll just write out the answer when it's worked out. It's equal to m pi cubed over 64 pi f pi squared alpha over pi squared times the number of colors times q up squared minus q down squared all squared. And if you put in the mass of the pion is 135, pi zero, of course. F pi was known from other experiments to be 93, both in units of millions of electron volts. Alpha is 1 over 137. Then that decay rate is equal to 7.6 EV times the number of colors squared times Q up squared minus Q down squared all squared. That's the theory. Gamma, I guess I better put a theory subscript here and an experiment subscript there. This turns out to be 7.9 EV plus or minus 7%. That is experiment. So, yeah. Sorry, you mean here? Yeah, but the pion goes here, and if you like, the gamma gammas go there. So that's how this is acting on this, basically. That's how that's understood. I've suppressed it, but that's what's actually there. So here we have wanted to get it all on one board, which I didn't quite do. What we have is that if, will it bother you if I write up here? Then I can do something different. All right, so what happens, of course, is that if Q up is 2/3 and Q down is negative 1/3, then this tells us the number of colors is 3. Because this is 4/9 minus 1/9, which is 3/9, which is 1/3. And we, oops, that should be there. So we have 1/3 time, we have NC over 3 squared, and that has to be of order unity, so NC better be 3. What's curious historically is that Adler used this to prove that quarks don't have fractional charge. He thought these might have charges, say, of 1 or 0, and the number of colors should be 1, and you still get the right answer. So if you believe quarks have the fractional charge assignments that Gell-Mann and Zweig thought they had in the mid-1960s, this provided indirect evidence the number of colors was 3. But there was a debate going on about whether or not quarks actually did have fractional charge, because no one had ever seen anything with fractional charge. Millikan's oil drop experiment says it's all integer charge. So if you believe this is 1 and this is 0, the number of colors had to be 1. Of course, we know what happened historically. It was this, but curiously enough, that's what Adler argued in his original paper. So this was the discovery of the anomaly. And what happened was people saw that if you actually did it and put in the pion masses, you didn't get this structure at all. You got this suppressed by a power of M pion mass over nucleon mass to some power, and it greatly suppressed this by a factor of 1,000. And that's what confused people. So there are corrections to this due to what's over there, but they're down by a factor of 10^-3. They're buried in the errors. So that's one implication of the anomaly, and that's how it was discovered in theoretical physics. Is this current is not only not conserved due to the mass of the pion, it's not conserved because of this structure right here. Okay, so any questions about that part? All right, so the next is renormalizability, which I've alluded to, but let's flesh this out a bit more, and unitarity. So the anomaly is a good thing with global currents. Which is what we just saw here, currents, sorry. So that's a good thing. But anomalies and gauged currents are bad. It doesn't do you any harm. Yeah, that's a happy face and a sad face. It helps you. If it was okay, it'd be flat. This is my code for okay. All right? But this, just to underscore the point, why is it? Well, if you had, suppose you gauge an axial current. So this would be a gamma mu, gamma 5. And this would be, let's say, two other gauge bosons. You could have a three-loop diagram like this, plus its counterparts. This would give a mass to the B mu coupling to J mu 5, right? Which is, the psi bar gamma mu gamma 5 term. If you gauge this current, it means you've introduced some gauge field that transforms with the axial, local axial phase rotation. And it's not conserved. And you might say, well, so what? But the so what is along comes something that you think doesn't have mass. Because the current isn't conserved, you can show this entire diagram generates a mass for this field. That mass introduces a new degree of freedom that destroys the renormalizability and unitarity of the theory. All the renormalizability proofs for gauge theories care about the gauge fields being massless and remaining so to all orders. Part of the problem in proving renormalizability of non-abelian gauge theories is that if the symmetry is broken, it's not so obvious the proof goes through. But it does go through because in the actual theory, the gauge bosons really are massless. They're coupling to scalar fields. So in the vacuum state, they gain a mass, but they're actually not really massless. So this will generate this diagram. If you had a mu index here and a nu index here, will generate a term in the vacuum polarization tensor that is like pi mu nu goes like 1 over k squared minus some b mass squared with a g mu nu plus other stuff. Yeah. It induces one effectively from corrections due to the anomaly. Yeah.
I mean, the same thing happens in the Higgs mechanism.
Like, yeah, but that's what I just said. The Higgs mechanism couples a massless gauge field to a scalar. So the actual theory you're renormalizing does not have a mass. It only gains a mass in the low energy state where you trade off degrees of freedom. But this would gain a mass at all orders for any energy level. This is not a vacuum state mass. So that's the difference. But the point did confuse people for quite a while. It's why renormalizability proved in QED for the 50s, took another 20 years to prove in the 1970s for non-abelian gauge theories when you spontaneously broke them. The proof goes through, but it goes through in that context. If you just give the gauge field a bare mass, it doesn't work. Yeah.
Could a gauge boson associated with an abelian symmetry have mass?
Pardon me?
Can a gauge boson associated with an abelian symmetry have mass?
Not and maintain renormalizability this way. You can if you spontaneously break it. But the problem is the renormalizability gets messed up. At least that's my understanding of the proofs. Now, of course, you can go through them with a fine-tooth comb and see if there's some assumption in there that maybe you could play with. But this is what caused people to realize these things. If you gauge them, it's bad news. Well, the theory loses predictive power. Nowadays, renormalizability doesn't seem to matter very much. People are proposing theories all over the place that violate renormalizability everywhere, and I think the argument is just that once you get up to the Planck mass, the whole theory will change, so we don't really care. But renormalizability, if you lose it, it means that you generate an arbitrary number of new kinds of couplings, and the coefficients are undetermined. So you have experiments to determine them, and you can just basically, this is the problem with perturbative quantum gravity. It agrees with every experiment because it's non-renormalizable. Every coupling is undetermined. It's rescaled by an infinity, so it'll agree with any experiment you want it to agree with. If it doesn't, just add a new coupling and you'll get agreement back.
But I mean, you can estimate how big those couplings should be in terms of like the various scales where you think the theory will be.
Well, that's right. That's the effective field theory argument. That you can induce or introduce a non-renormalizable coupling, its coupling constant will be scaled by some power of a mass, and it'll be fine for physics below that mass scale or energy scale. Above that, something brand new replaces it. And people have sort of stopped worrying about what that something brand new is, typically. At least that's my observation of what goes on in the field. But
in this case, it's that the mass that would be induced from that non-renormalizable coupling would be huge compared to what you actually see. Is that the
yeah? In general, it could be yes, because you'd have yeah, sure, yeah, yeah.
Did you say this also screws up unitarity?
Well, yeah, the proofs are connected to each other. I'm not highly familiar with them, but if you have a gauge theory that's not renormalizable, it also ends up destroying the unitarity of the theory. The reason is that gauge bosons, let's stick to the real world of 3 plus 1, a vector potential has four components, and the massless field has two polarization states. So what happens to the other two? Well, what happens in the proofs basically is the zero-zero component is canceled by the longitudinal-longitudinal component. And that cancellation persists to all orders. If you give it a mass, then the longitudinal component can no longer cancel the time-time component, and you get a state with negative norm, and that ruins unitarity. Roughly speaking, that's how it goes. All right. So if you have axial currents in the theory, and the theory of weak interactions suggests we do, there are all kinds of pseudoscalars and pseudovector particles that exist as bound states of quarks, And the theory of weak interaction seems to require, if you're back in the 1950s and 60s, some kind of gauged axial current, though people tried all kinds of ideas. But if you believe that was the case, then your only hope is to cancel off the anomaly. And so you have something like this. Nu b lambda c plus the cross diagram. And as we looked at last week, the divergence of that thing, or the four momentum of this boson dotted into this, gives you a structure that's proportional to the trace of TA, TB, TC, plus the trace of TA, TC, TB, times this epsilon, whatever, nu alpha lambda beta, P1 alpha, P1 beta, P2 beta, sorry. Which is proportional to the trace of TA with the anti-commutator of TBTC. Oops. And so, we've got to get rid of that thing, and how can we do it? So, renormalizability is okay if A, let's just call this thing capital A, this trace, as long as this trace is zero, we're fine. There isn't any other way of doing it. We can't kill off the epsilon structure because the photon momenta have to be arbitrary. There isn't anything else in here that we can use to cancel the structure off. So, how? Well, there are several ways of doing it. One, oh, let me write something else before I get to that. In terms of left-handed and right-handed fermions, if we break things up that way, then this thing is equal to the trace of the left-handed parts. Minus the trace of the right-handed parts. Left and right do not couple to each other. And the right-handed things have to have a minus sign for their axial current relative to the left-handed ones. So this is a bit more useful in the sense we can ask, how do we do this? And there are several different answers to this problem. One way is if T left is some unitary transformation of T right, or vice versa. That will work. Because it should be clear, if I put in, if I replace T left by U T right U dagger, all the UU dagger terms will cancel each other, and I'll just get this to be the T right structure, which will cancel that one, and I'll get nothing. So what that means in this theory, that left-handed and right-handed fermions are and basically they're in the same representation, or they're in equivalent representations. The generator transforming the right-handed guys is unitarily equivalent to the ones transforming the left-handed guys. And in fact, you have no axial current in such a theory. We have psi bar right, gamma mu t right, psi right, plus psi bar left, gamma mu t left, psi left. And that turns out to equal psi bar prime, gamma mu t right, psi prime. When you put this transformation into here, then you can absorb the U into this and the U inverse into that, and then add up the two together. Psi prime is just psi right plus U psi left. So this is a vector theory. It basically is the same as saying I have no axial couplings in the theory. So that's a vector-like theory. QCD is an example of this kind of theory. Left and right-handed quarks have the same color charges. A left-handed up quark has the same color charges as a right-handed up quark, up to unitarity. So you might as well just make them the same thing. Okay, reason number two is if T left star is minus V T left V inverse, where V is unitary, in which case the trace of T left A, T B left, T C left, is equal to the trace, if you take the dagger of this whole thing, you get the trace of TA left star, TB left star, TC left star. And that turns out by this relationship here, because of this minus sign, to be minus the trace of TA left, TB left, TC left. And of course, whenever a thing is minus itself, you get zero. So the dagger takes you from here to there. If you take the dagger of the trace, it has to be the trace, and you'll get this thing and this thing by this relationship. So this is used here. You'll get that. And so in this case, these are called a pseudo-real representation of the fermions, or a real representation. In other words, the representation is equivalent to its complex conjugate, kind of like a Majorana fermion, basically. Yeah. Well, you can put in, if you actually put in the indices, you get TAL is equal to TAL star IJ is equal to TA star JI, and when you put that in, you get that when you shuffle the indices around, basically. All right, reason number three, or method number three, sorry, is anomaly. Is to make the theory anomaly safe so it has complex conjugate representations, or it has complex reps, but no anomalies. In other words, there's a cancellation here. And so only those groups are potentially anomalous. Symplectic groups are not potentially anomalous. E7 and E8 are not potentially anomalous. They'll fall into the other categories. SU2 has real representations. It's in category 2. So it is not a problem, and I should put not SO6. Don't need those brackets, I guess. Somebody had a question? No? Okay. Yeah.
How does this work technically? Like, what do you mean that the anomalies cancel?
Well, I'm going to show them. I haven't got there yet, but they're, yeah, what they're going to do is you're going to basically have enough stuff in the theory such that these traces all add up to give zero. Each individual trace by itself is not zero. So in other words, what's going to happen, notice here we basically had two different kinds of traces. So here we'd be anomaly free if the charge of the up was the same as the charge of the down. It's not, but if it were, that would be an example of anomaly cancellation. And so that's the idea here. And actually, these two groups are okay, as it turns out. Because TBTC, I guess, the anti-commutator of two generators for those groups goes like the gauge fields have to be in the adjoint representation. So this anti-commutator is in the has to be located in the symmetric product of an adjoint tensored with an adjoint, but that is not in the adjoint rep. And so this anti-commutator, this is adjoint, but this is not in the adjoint, so the trace of adjoint with non-adjoint gives you zero. For these two groups. So they are potentially anomalous, but in fact, these are safe. So all that's left are U1 and SUN when N is greater than 3. Those are the only groups that are potentially dangerous. And it turns out, of course, that the standard model has those groups in it, and we have to be concerned with that. Of course, the standard model turns out to be anomaly safe, but it turns out to be so for reasons of cancellation instead of something simpler, shall we say. How am I doing for time here? I got about 10 minutes. There's a bit of group theory about how to do this that maybe I'll skip over. I'll just show you for the standard model. What have we got? Well, we've got this basic triangle graph, and there'll be a generator here, a generator here, and a generator here. And the group is SU3 cross SU2 left cross U1. Now we might think, well, gee, what's the problem? This is vector-like, this is safe, so that's the only dangerous part. But it's not quite that simple, because every quark, every lepton going through here has a generator that's in a representation of this product. So for quarks, we have the representations are a color triplet and a weak doublet. A color triplet and a weak singlet. Oops, that's right. And another color triplet and a weak singlet. And for leptons, they're all color singlets, but we have a left-handed doublet and we have a right-handed singlet. So this is the U1 charge. So the representation is, well, I hope it's obvious. This is the SU3, this is the SU2, that's the U1 for each of these things. So in general, you'll have these kinds of quarks flowing around the loop, these kinds, all of them together. So what is safe here let's see. We have to look at this piece by piece, and the tricks you have to use are, which I won't go into the detail for, but maybe this could be done in a tutorial. The directs, A for a direct sum is the sum of the A's. And A for a product of representations is equal to the dimension of R1 times A of R2 plus the dimension of R2 times A of R1. So because this is a product structure, you can use this and this to break up these traces into pieces like so and evaluate the pieces. And there's some arithmetic involved in that, that, yeah.
What is R?
R means some representation. So for representation R1, R2, we can use this. So if you have a direct sum of representations, the arithmetic is this. If you have a direct product, it's that. And to go through that arithmetic, we'll use up the rest of the class. So I'd rather finish off this standard model thing. Yeah.
Just a quick question. Will things change much if you include the right-handed neutrinos?
Well, that's what these are. No. I mean, they will all be neutral and they won't do anything. So this is electron and its neutrino partner, and this is left-handed electron and its neutrino partner, left-handed mu and its neutrino partner. This is right-handed electron, right-handed mu, et cetera. So if there were left-handed neutrinos, right-handed neutrinos, you'd have to decide what rep they were in. And sure, you could invent representations that would violate this, but you better not do that. Or you'll ruin the properties of the theory. So let me show you, or just point out what happens here. if it's all, if you break it up into the parts where this is the SU3 part for each, you've got SU3 cubed, and that is safe by the fact that it's vector-like. I guess that's in the board behind here. If you look at the SU2 parts, they're safe because SU2 is real, has real representations. So SU3, here are the ones that are okay. SU2 cubed, SU3 with SU2 or U1 squared and SU2 with SU3 or U1 squared are all okay. In other words, if you use this arithmetic and look at those pieces, everything there is fine. Where it's not fine is SU3 squared with U1, SU2 squared with U1. Let me put it here. SU2 squared with U1 and U1 cubed. So the U1 parts of each of these are dangerous. And if you have SU2, SU2, and a U1 generator here, that's potentially dangerous, and likewise for SU3. So you just actually have to do the arithmetic using these rules. And it turns out that this works out to be 2 times a sixth minus 2/3 minus 1/3, and that's 0. And this one turns out to be 3 times a sixth minus 1 or plus 1 times negative 1/2, and that's 0. And then this one is 3 times 2 times a sixth cubed minus 3 times 1 times 2/3 cubed plus 3 times negative 1/3 cubed plus 1 times 2 times negative 1/2 cubed plus 1 times 1 times negative 1 cubed, and that's 0. So what is this? What does this mean? Let's look at this one. I think it's the easiest to understand. So from the perspective of the U1 charges of these things, I've got a U1, a U1, a U1. So for this guy, I'll have the 1/6 charge here, the 1/6 charge here, the 1/6 charge here. I have 3 colors and it's a doublet. So I get 3 colors for each doublet times the 1/6 at each vertex. What about that guy? Well, that's this one. For the right-handed upcharm top, I have the 2/3 at each vertex times 3 colors times 1 singlet for the week, and so on. For the down-type quarks that are right-handed, I should write 3 times 1, 3 colors, 1 singlet, and 1/3, minus 1/3 for each of their U1 charges. For the leptons, I have color singlet, left-handed doublet, and minus 1/2 for the hypercharge at each vertex. I have, for the last one, I have color singlet, weak singlet, and negative 1 charge for the right-handed electron, right-handed mu, right-handed tau. So this number non-trivially adds to 0. Yeah.
Right-handed neutrinos, they usually have charge 1, 1, 1, right? They're sterile under all 3.
I guess.
1, 1, 0, right?
Pardon me?
Is it 1, 1, 0?
What do they have, 0 charge? U1
hypercharge? Yes.
I don't know if they have U1 hypercharge. Yeah, I haven't done a lot of work with sterile neutrinos, so I don't remember the arithmetic. But
if you introduced a sterile neutrino, it would have to fit into this pattern if you wanted your model to be renormalizable. You wouldn't have any choice. So the logic here is similar to the other kind of logic. You've got two vertices with an SU2 generator, one with that, and maybe I'll talk to Dan and Tibra. They can show you a little bit of the arithmetic that allows you to draw these conclusions, but I hope this one is the clearest, right? If you just looked at the U1 pieces of these currents going in here, then you would have to get that. And people believed, maybe still do, that this cancellation is non-trivial. It's a bit like, it reminds me a little bit of what happens in quantum physics with non-locality. It's as though nature wants to play as dangerously as it can to violating causality by introducing non-local correlations, but it doesn't let you send a signal. Here, the real world wants to play as dangerously as it can with anomalies, but putting in all of the representations to kill them off. I mean, why not use some other group of nature that is completely safe, but we don't do that. Why this is, we do not know. It's a fact of our world that we have these charges and they cancel this way. But why the world is that way is a separate question. And it was this view that led people to think anomalies were very important and had to cancel out, and the corresponding triangle type calculation was done in string theory, except it was in 10 dimensions, and it's a bit different. We might look at that later. But basically, the analog of this cancellation turned out to be the choice of group itself. You basically went back to this and discovered that every group gave you a problem except SO32 or E8 cross E8 in string theory, or whatever the other ones are. There were five choices, SO32, E8 cross E8. What are the other ones? I forget. Well, then there's variants where you switch left and right, chiral or something. Yeah, that's right. So that's all that worked. Yeah, that's true, okay. So anyway, we should stop here, but I didn't get time to do the U1 problem. That's a third application of the anomaly, but I don't know if I'll be able to do that next time or not, but that's how that is. Okay, we're done.